This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station. Night School on BFM 89.9.
Hi, I'm Sharad Kutin, and welcome to the show that walks you through some fundamental concepts in the social sciences and humanities. Together with Amat Fuad Ramat, the show tries to reveal how various thinkers have grappled with theories and concepts to best understand how society works. Each week, Fuad or I will lead a discussion on a concept or a classic text we hope will shed light on the world around you. Except this week, again, we have a guest, and it's Cheryl Hamdan, who has a master's from the London School of Economics in post-colonial studies with an emphasis on race and ethnicity. So, Cheryl, maybe you could explain to us, what is it to do a master's on post-colonial studies? I mean, just very briefly.
A master's in post-colonial studies is really a master's in one of the branches of sociology, and it deals with the contemporary realities, contemporary structures in post-colonial societies, which means you focus more on countries that used to be colonized, let's say, and how the impact of colonialism has shaped the way people look at themselves and how, you know, nations look at themselves.
This would not be limited to, say, British colonies. It would also include the French or the Portuguese.
Absolutely, yeah.
And maybe German colonies as well, right?
It would.
Fuad, are you familiar with the whole sort of area of post-colonial studies? Is something that interests you?
Yes, somewhat. Mainly on the question of whether or not the term post-colonial itself is relevant still, because many people argue that the colonial period never really ended, right? It was a shift in those who hold the bureaucracy, right? The British held the Malaysian bureaucracy, for example, and they left, and then they passed it over to the Malaysians to run the bureaucracy, but the problems in that bureaucracy are still the same. So they have people who argue that the term post-colonial is a bit of a misnomer.
Right, should be neo-colonial.
Or late colonial,
yeah. So, I mean, I delve into those discussions before. It's pretty interesting because it's, especially as Malaysians, a lot of relevant questions there.
Right, so this is what a philosopher does, right? And he doesn't get into the substance of things. He just wants to interrogate the term.
Yeah.
Let's not start until we figure out whether this term actually means
something.
It's an
infinite postponement of actually doing anything.
Guilty.
Okay, so Cheryl, you're talking to us about the work of Homi Bhabha. And the idea of nation and narration. Maybe outline for us what Homi Bhabha's kind of thoughts are on this
and
issue.
And also, while you're on that, why it matters now at this particular juncture in Malaysian politics?
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I think the latter part will go through as discussions evolve. But, you know, let me just set the context a bit. So Homi Bhabha, he's a sociologist. He belongs to the school of, I'll place him somewhere between critical theory and cultural studies. So what he tries to do is, what the discipline tries to do really, is try to examine and expose the grayness, if you like, of things we take for granted in terms of enlightenment project type of categories.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if you like, you know, things that we take for granted like democracy. You know, we think that's a good thing. Nation, we think that's a given thing. And even in political liberalism, one of the criticisms that sociology has of that discipline is that it seems to think of morality within the sphere of nation, as if that was always the case, and, you know, there's no space for another way of looking at ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what critical sociology does, and I think at the forefront of this is someone like, you know, Homi Bhabha.
Mm-hmm.
So particularly in this text, it's a book called Nation and Narration, and it's a collection of articles, a collection of writings, but particularly one that is of interest here today is the introduction by Bhabha himself. It's not very long. I think it's probably all of five pages. But, you know, it links also to other texts that he has written.
So this would be a very dense five pages, I imagine, because for those of us who have encountered Bhabha's writing, it perhaps doesn't have the lightness and breeziness of, say, a I don't know. Let's think of somebody who writes...
George Orwell, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. Or F.R. Leavis. People have been encountered, actually, in the show before.
And he won an award for being for that reason, for being a very dense writer.
For writing the worst prose, I think.
Yeah, it was like that.
So not much of an award, that one.
In his defense, his comeback was that, look, if we accept that scientists can write in language that normal, you know, people who don't read science can't understand, why is it do we expect that philosophers, you know, can't do the same?
I have a response for that. It's because scientists never claim to be radical or never claim to do emancipatory work. They just claim to describe the world.
The truth.
Yeah, whereas critical theorists, their project is always addressing some political problem, right? So, I mean, that's just...
Well, and therefore, they should speak to the public. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Or a language that is not as difficult for public to understand. I mean, that's one argument. Yeah,
yeah, and this is an argument we should come back to, because I think there's the other side, which is the kind of rigor and discipline in describing the world that perhaps then renders the description rather... non-commonplace, you know, the expressions might not be, and it does require some work, but that's no reason to dismiss it just because hard to do, right? Hard to understand or read.
Correct.
Sorry. Okay, let's get back to the text.
Yep. So his central premise in this text and in other texts related to this is that, you know, nation is temporal, the temporality of nation. And by that, he means that the nation is always in the process of being made. And this stands in opposition to a more historical / originary conception of the nation. Right? So it's in this process of making is where narration comes in. So he speaks then of the discursive formations and how, you know, by discursive formations, of course, thinks that, you know, all the ways in which our ideas and our beliefs are represented through cultural systems, through cultural institutions, through even things like laws and the state.
So this would run counter against the perception of a nation as some pristine, originary, primordial, authentic ideal.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
For him, it's always in the process of reshaping itself.
Correct.
But isn't it, or would somebody who says, well, does that make sense? I mean, we know that Malaysia was established on September 16th, 1963, and that, you know, we have documents to prove that, and that was it. I mean, you know, the borders were established, it was accepted internationally by international law and the international community. What does it mean to talk about the nation state evolving after that point?
So that rendition is a particularly narrow and factual / dry way of looking at it, right? And if that was the case, if it was just that, if what that 10-second bit that you just did was all that we hear from historians and from people who speak of the nation, then that's fine. But what Baba is worried, what Baba's concern is that underneath all these statements about, you know, we started in 63 or what have you, there is more, it's a lot more than that. It comes from an idea that Malaysia was, you know, the start of Malaysia started, say, Parameswara to the different points of colonialism. So there's a particular narrative, right? It's almost a linear narrative from Parameswara all the way to today. And there are different, obviously, milestones in between where, you know, some get more elevated or amplified than others. So his critique, if you like, is that in all renditions of the nation as we look at it, nation as a concept, there is a tendency to look at it in a linear way, as though we are moving from some, you know, heathen past to a Zen future, right? So what he's saying is that it's always in a process of making, and what's key in this way he's looking at it is that it is almost random. It's almost temporal, or it's completely temporal, and it is as if it was particular to the time and place and the needs of that particular, you know, space, that time.
So, for example, I mean, the common narrative would say that Malaysia was established in this and that date, but Homi Baba would say, yes, maybe that was the case, but look, there's so many unresolved questions about identity that remains to haunt us, like policy on language, national language, for example, or the place of the Sharia. These things are still being negotiated, and negotiated in a lot of risk of conflict as well as in that process.
Even the Sulu and Lahadatu conflict of recent months has shown that, in fact, the borders are porous.
Exactly.
That we are...
Literally and figuratively.
Yeah, and, you know, and there are multiple identities, actually. The space and identity issues don't are not coterminous in some sort of simple way, right? Malaysianness doesn't stop at the borders. Correct. And... Sulu identity, you know, has in fact invaded Sabah or has been part of Sabah, even though it's been denied in many ways, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think, you know, just taking off from that, there's a quote that I want to read from his text, which he says, "There's a tendency to read the nation restrictively, either as an ideological state apparatus, ISA, or an expression of the national popular sentiment preserved in radical memory." So, what he's trying, if you can digest his wonderfully ethereal way of writing things, what he's trying to say then is that the space that he wants us to occupy is somewhere between a cynical view of how the state just controls everything, the state tells you what the nation then just becomes a vessel of state interests. Mm-hmm. That's one way, Marxist way of looking at it. Then there's the other end that says, you know, okay, if we don't like the bourgeois or the establishment way of how the nation is narrated and how history is narrated, and we hear this all the time in Malaysia, right? That there was an elitist way of history. Then we should find, therefore, a more authentic, you know, sentiment or authentic origin of what Malaysia is. That Malaysia is rich of this and that, the other, there's different narrative, blah, blah, blah. What he's saying is that he doesn't like either. He doesn't like the idea that state controls everything and we're just subjects blind to what they're doing. He doesn't think that's true. On the other hand, he doesn't think there is an alternative, authentic vision either. What what he's persuading us to look at is that it's a lot less dramatic. The truth is that nation is then therefore just a process of being constructed. It's contingent on a number of things, depends on the needs and requirements of the day, and therefore it's accidental. It's almost accidental. And the implication of this, and this is to your point, to your question earlier, why do we care? It throws up some really interesting questions, right, about identity. Then, if it was accidental, if it was contingent, and it remains to be contingent all the time, how I look at myself as a Malaysian, Malayness, also, you know, just continuous slippages in terms of race, class, sexuality, then how then do we begin to relate ourselves as subjects to this idea of a nation that looms large all the time? Right, and we were born into a nation. We were born to the world, thinking that we're Malaysians, and whatever meanings attached to that. It's a very pessimistic way to look at things. But if this was indeed the truth, then you know it throws up really, really tough questions on how one sees oneself.
Does he have a concept that encapsulates this idea of the contingency of the nation, or its, you know, infinitely contested nature, it's, you know, the fact that it's constantly in play? Does he have a concept that sort of encapsulates that?
I would imagine it would be ambivalence. So he's one of the leading writers on this concept of ambivalence, the other being Zygmunt Bauman, which I like as well. So ambivalence in multiple ways, right? Ambivalence, number one, in obviously, as we've discussed, the construction of the nation and how it was, you know, could have been done in a different way, therefore it's ambivalent. It's also ambivalent in the relationship between the individual and the state. Right, I think, and this is where I think it gets a bit more interesting, especially for a Malaysian audience.
Oh, so ambivalence. And is ambivalence, I mean, what is the status of the notion of ambivalence? Are we looking at things in a kind of literary, poetic sense of ambivalence? Are we talking about, you know, kind of structures of experience of how people relate to, say, state structures as opposed to how they relate to the, you know, sentiments of around the nation state?
Or even themselves. Right? Could you be ambivalent about your own identity? Is that what he's calling for? Yeah, is that what he's calling
us to
confront?
That's the implication. But I think there are two types. I think you outline both. One is the ambivalence of the structure itself. Mm-hmm. So what we think as boundaries are porous, they move depending on contingent. It's contingent, right? So that's ambivalent one. And ambivalent two, if you like, is how then the impact on the subject, the citizen. Mm-hmm.
Coming up next, we'll talk more about Homi Bhabha's notion of ambivalence in his work Nation and Narration. You're listening to Cheryl Hamdan, Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, and myself, Sharad Kutan. This is Night School on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, this is Night School with Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, Cheryl Hamdan, and myself, Sharad Kutin. Cheryl was talking about our heathen past and our Zen future. I just love the phrase. I'm going to see if we can patent it. Okay, Cheryl, maybe you could just quickly reiterate what you said about ambivalence and the nation, and then we'll work from there.
Okay, so I think before we went for a break, we decided to discuss two dimensions of ambivalence. One is ambivalence around the structure, which is around the ideology of the nation, if you like. All this, the institutions that support the nation, that prop up a particular rendition of the nation. So there's ambivalence around that, and we want to explore that. And secondly, ambivalence, therefore, on the subject or citizen. So how the citizen looks at himself or herself in relation to the nation. Mm-hmm. So how I see my citizenship, does that evolve over time? Does that change when certain structures change? Mm-hmm. And do I then, over the course of my life, think differently about identity and my patriotism or my loyalty to the mm-hmm. nation versus other forms of collective identities?
This notion of ambivalence that you describe, it seems it hinges on some desire for permanence, some desire for stability. Mm. Right, and because the nation isn't stable and isn't permanent, one is necessarily confronted with this sense of ambivalence. You feel like you start distrusting the ideology that you were raised up with. You yeah. start feeling uneasy with your understanding about yourself. But isn't the source of this the state, though? Because it is the state that is imposing finite and fixed borders. It is the state that is demanding this sort of fictional permanence, right? Because imagine without a state in the equation, there's really not that much of an issue with cultural evolution.
There'll be other forms of the demand for you to conform, for you mm-hmm. to fit in. Mm-hmm. So if it wasn't the state, there will be some, the ideas, there will be some other authority, right, that acts as a state.
But like a village or yeah. society or region.
Like social pressures. Well, it's true, but wouldn't the spaces be more open? Say, for example, the Peranakan identities, right? I mean, that's a good example of how before the nation state, cultural interaction, cultural evolution was just more porous. It happened more harmoniously, relatively, one would say.
He's talking about the Zen past.
But no, I'm not trying to idealize it. But I just want to show point to one of the key source of the ambivalence. And I just worry we might downplay the value of the state.
So I think you're onto something. I wouldn't say it's the state. I would say maybe modernity. So modernity defined as an era or epoch that we're in still, right? Or maybe we're postmodern now. But modernity in the sense that, one of the tenets of modernity, as I read it, as somebody else wrote it and I read it, is that he wants to place an order, right? It's a constant ordering system. So this is from Zygmunt Bauman, by the way, another plug. He says the modernity is a process of ordering, but it's also a process that cannot be complete and cannot be perfect. So when he says order, it's an order of categories. Modernity introduced the idea of binary, mm-hmm. binary way of looking at things. That's his proposition. And in looking at Baba's text, and in thinking of ambivalence from Baba's lens, I think it's very related to the idea of modernity. And modernity, therefore, is the cause of ambivalence. If we're gonna go down that path, as you put it forward. So in this case, if the state then becomes a tool of modernity, if you like. Or rather an expression of modernity and the process of ordering. It is then, trying to order the nation in, first, of course, in the boundaries. Second, in how, certain identities are elevated or more placed in higher importance or higher value than other identities. Mm. You can think of, Malaysia has to be, say, it's not Malaysian, say, to be homosexual. Mm-hmm. That could be one, right? It's never stated like that, but the institutions and structures.
It has been stated like that recently.
Has it?
Okay.
But you can imagine.
Definitely the kind of hierarchy of identities,
if you like. Yeah. Some people are more Malaysian than others. Mm-hmm. Some people are more British than others. Some people are whatever, more dash than others. Mm-hmm. And in that process of ordering, it's not complete and it's never perfect. That's the in-between space of modernity, right? And that's where we link Baba and Bauman if you want to do that shift. Mm-hmm. It is also then, now we're linking a couple other writers, it's also Gramscian hegemony. which is hegemony is never totalizing, although the state or, you know, whoever, state and bourgeois try to tell you X, you know, this is how you need to live your lives and these are the authority systems that you shall abide by, it's always contingent on the moment. And so therefore, even the state dilutes its adherence to those particular symbols that it pushes to the citizens.
I wanted to jump in then, working from this idea of Gramsci's notion of hegemony, and also I was curious about Baba's choice of the word ambivalence. Why not a notion of, say, contestation or resistance, or in a kind of Gramscian thing, counter-hegemony? Yep. What is productive about using the notion of ambivalence as opposed to all these other concepts?
That's a fair challenge, and it's one that I don't have a very good answer to. I think that's where Baba and this particular branch of sociology has its weakness. It wants to describe the world. It is critical of other descriptions of the world. It doesn't always, it's not always clear what the implication of action is. Yeah, so it's someone like Professor Chandran, whom you guys had on the show a couple of weeks ago, he would be very, very critical of this because it's opposite to what he thinks political theory should be.
Well, one of the common criticisms of postcolonial studies in general is that it does not commit, at least explicitly, to any notion of resistance, especially in the case of Spivak or Baba, because they believe that that notion assumes an idea of alienation that is rooted to the Western conception of the subject. So which is supposed to be this autonomous, self-owning sort of subject, which they believe only specific to the Western context and cannot be easily imported into outside of that. Or even they even go so far as to say it's problematic in the first place, you know, so.
Right. So, yeah. I mean, what I'm getting from this is that, okay, so so with ambivalence, you have a kind of double move. The subject in opposition to the state, say the citizen, is perhaps contesting the official idea, narrative, or ordering of identities, but at the same time is tied to the state, is seduced by it, or is attracted to it. So ambivalence is this double kind of move, right? So the subject is in a kind of
flux,
or, you know, in a funk, really. Yeah, you know, you can't. It's not so simple as, yeah, I know they're trying to control me and I'm resisting it. It's more like I'm not really sure.
It's like a double bind.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So that's why I think he doesn't say there's an obvious implication on what citizens have to do, which is what a Marxist reading would say, right? Mm-hmm. Therefore, you need to do X, Y, Z, rise up, what have you. But what he's saying is, he's not interested so much in what happens next. He's saying this is just the order of modernity, and this is how a nation is. And it's up to us, then, therefore, the reader, to think of what the implication is. Is it do we take a Marxist reading of it? Do we take a more Foucault reading of it, where it's just, you know, this is just the fact that's ambivalent and there's in-between spaces is actually a sign of stability rather than a sign of chance for resistance. Mm-hmm. That modernity has found in a sense of equilibrium, which is always in movement. Mm-hmm. And the fact that the state is never totalizing, the fact that, as you pointed out, Sharad, people understand that the state is doing something to them, but they're not entirely sure how they feel about it. And they're both enchanted and also aware of the fact that they're being enchanted.
Well, that's interesting. So here you have an idea of the nation, or a description of the nation and the nation state as being in crisis, but that crisis is productive. It actually, as you say, it creates stability rather than pushes towards sort of breaking with the system, right?
Correct. It's like a good marriage, I've been told.
Oh,
a good marriage? Well, I thought a marriage, but not necessarily a good one. But that crisis actually puts nation in view, right? The idea that you're wrestling with these questions mean that there's something for you to aim for. I mean, it's sort of like, I mean, the case of UMNO is interesting, right? You have the supposedly more bourgeois, more kind of modern and Western educated Malay nationalists, but you also have the not so modern, kind of harking back to perhaps the likes of Zul Noordin or Ibrahim Ali, presenting a different narrative of Malay identity, but this is sort of what makes UMNO UMNO, right?
Yeah.
The fact that it can house these otherwise odd personalities together for a common project.
Yeah. UMNO is Catholic.
It is a universal church of Malay nationalism. Okay, so
my silence is conspicuous.
So where do we go from here?
So I think what raised a very interesting point in using UMNO and using Malayness as an example. One thing, if you can just explore very quickly before the end, is the co-constitution of identities. So nation. We've explored nation as a concept, as a vessel of identity, if you like. But how then does the nation impact other categories, such as in Malaysia, the most important being race? So I think it's important for us to explore how you can't think of Malaysia without, if you like, Malay. You can't think of Malay without Malaysia. And that, I think that's pretty obvious. It's pretty self-evident. But in both categories, there are demands of authenticity. Being Malaysian means you must do XYZ. Being Malay means you must be XYZ. And in both categories, there's ambivalence. And the ambivalence in one category impacts the other.
Mm.
Right? So let's challenge us to be a bit more real here. So let's say, you know, being Malay means in the constitution, we know there are a few things that you have to supposedly do to be Malay. You have to supposedly be to be Malay. But there's also an idea of an authentic Malayness, which is rooted, say, in the rural living, in an idea that I own this land, it's my land, in an idea of somehow Malayness being a bit more gentle and a more accommodating. What's not said, of course, is that therefore the other ethnicities are not.
Mm-hmm.
But that's by the by. And at the same time, for you to live up to an idea of Malayness as a subject, I think there are throws up very interesting contradictions, right? As a subject, you are aware of these authentic demands of authenticity of being a Malay, yeah. At the same time, you're enchanted by, say, cosmopolitanism. You know, you're multicultural. You have the most multicultural friends. And the reason I brought this up is because I think anecdotally we know of so many cases. I'm no otherwise of people who in their daily lives live the most liberal / non-religious way of life, but in political statements suddenly become the most conservative and mm-hmm. the most reactionary of people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think rather than saying these are just hypocrites, that's one way of looking at it, but more interestingly is seeing how is this an expression of ambivalence in identity?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right? It's not as though they're not always a calculated. You know, we tend to think of politicians as calculated right. animals, right? But they're not always that. It could be an expression of split identity, you know, mm-hmm. something like that, right? Where you know there's an authentic demand of authenticity. At the same time, you know that's not how you live,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and maybe you compensate for that. Maybe you try and live up to certain tenets. If you can't live up to the rest, and the most important ones are being, just Malay land, mm-hmm. what have you. So, I'm thinking, as Malaysians, do we do that as well? As Malaysians and as subjects that relate to the idea of the nation, do we do that as well? Do mm-hmm. we feel actually in the back of our heads, look, I don't know if I'm the most patriotic of persons or people. I don't know if how I view about the idea of a nation, and especially among middle class folks like ourselves, we maybe have exposures outside the nation, and we are kind of aware that different ways of identity and identification. But at the same time, there's a certain loyalty that's very hard to describe mm-hmm. in a way that says I'm being calculated and there's something for me to gain. There's nothing for me to gain.
Mm-hmm.
But there's this loyalty that I think is born out of the subject's identity, subject's relation to mm-hmm. the nation as a modern object.
No, I think that's a really fascinating description of the, like you said earlier, the ambivalence of identity. Right? My only worry is that contradiction or is that incongruence that we try to balance in our identities, right? Is it something that's dynamic and aesthetic, or is it just something that's born out of fear, right? That ultimately, regardless of how liberal we are, we support you know, we end up supporting conservative or reactionary position because that's what we turn to feel at home, right? So which side wins is the bigger question too in that, yeah.
But I'm wondering also, you know, for Baba, you're saying that he's not concerned with the kind of political implications or import of his theory. He's not saying, okay, therefore, understanding this, therefore we can construct on the basis of this critical view of the nation some sort of politics, right? He's calling for a constant interrogation, perhaps, of the way in which the world is described. The project is much more of a kind of a negative one. I mean, in the sense that it's about thinking critically about how ambivalence might operate in daily life, in literature, in film, in, you know, all forms of cultural expression, but also in the way in which the nation operates. Is that how it works out, or is the work Nation and Narration purely kind of theoretical statement?
So I think 80% is that, but to be fair to him, he does hint, or more than hint, of what implication might be, even if he doesn't spell it out very specifically in terms of actual actions, right? So grounding this still to the idea of a nation, a text about nation, he says, you know, there is the implication, therefore, is because of this ambivalence, you are then aware of the other. You are aware of my complex relationship to people outside, the subject outside the boundary of the nation. If it wasn't ambivalent, if I was completely bought by this idea of the nation, ideology of the nation, then my relationship with the other would be very clear, which is that he is not of me. But because of ambivalence, because you're aware and you're in a semi-trance, if you like, of being one with the nation, also being difficult, having a difficult relationship with it, then the implication therefore is perhaps a more international dimension, perhaps a more you know, cross-boundary type of collective identification becomes possible. And he quotes Fanon, and I'm struggling to find a quote, I can get it here, but it's something along the lines of, it is in our most national of moments that we find the international dimension, right? So it's kind of like a contradictory statement, but what he's trying to say is, because our relationship to the idea of the nation is so complex, and it's never one way, and it's never perfect, you therefore become a bit more, you know, the subject then therefore becomes a bit more open to the idea of international solidarity, so if we go that way.
So this is Frantz Fanon, the psychologist from Martinique.
Correct.
Who wrote
Wretched
Earth.
I found a quote, actually. Can I read it out?
Right, yeah.
Sure. He says, "National consciousness, which is not nationalism, is the only thing that will give us an international dimension." So that's Fanon.
I wonder, though, if it necessarily follows that our ambivalence leads us to a more open attitude, because you can easily argue that our ambivalence leads us to a more closed attitude because we want to somehow seek resolution to the ambivalence. What was the move that Homi Bhabha made in the argument to say that this ambivalence will more likely lead to an open attitude?
If your identity is ambivalent, it therefore means your main loyalty is always shifting. It's contingent to the moment, and therefore it's not necessarily a shift, it's just the way things already are.
Mm-hmm.
That you are not just Malaysian, you're both Malaysian, Malay, citizen of the world, middle class.
Okay.
So it's that co-constitution and having multiple identities at once and an ambivalent relation to each of them and an ambivalent relationship between them that produces this reality of having both national and international way of looking at things.
Why not make the move and say national identity is fictive? Why say it's ambivalent? Why dwell on the ambivalence? Why not say that this is not really, this is just a construct? I mean, yeah. We can relinquish it because it's a fiction. Anyway, yeah, that was just my question. Should I formulate it more completely?
No, that's fine. I mean, but I like to say that just, you know, because there's much in sociology that turns on this idea that that social reality is constructed. But to say something is constructed is not to say it isn't experienced as real and material, that it doesn't actually have a material force, or, you know, so you can't dismiss something by the kind of recognition that it's constructed. The constructedness is only to kind of recognize its historically contingent and constantly changing nature, potentially,
yeah,
right?
But to say that something is constructed is not necessarily to say something is fictive, right? Fictive is a kind of disjoint with reality. So, yeah. But, yeah, I get your point. Yeah.
But is there a reality that we can point to without somehow that is not related to some form of
construction
of narration?
Sure. Class struggle. anyway, that's a
plug.
Okay, so maybe coming to the end of the show now, just to maybe make some suggestions about how Baba could be read. Does the work do some close reading of texts, of literary texts or political texts or analysis of history? How exactly can we productively read this text?
I think I would suggest that we read this text in a collection of other texts that deals with identity. So identity and identification. And it's one text which focuses on only one particular dimension of our identification. And we've discussed that we have multiple identifications at one time, right? And it deals with one of the more important ones I would suggest as Malaysians, right? Which is your relationship to the nation, to the idea of the nation, and how that impacts your other identifications in terms of sub-nation identifications, and if you like ethnicity, and also above nations, as whether it's a global ummah, whether it's an international way of solidarity. I would suggest this text be one of the more central ones as we begin to explore what we think about our own identifications. I think what this show and what we're trying to do is, what you guys are trying to do, is really to bring to bear, to expose things that, appear natural, appear taken for granted. And knowing that, part of that journey, I think one important aspect is identification, and this is a central text in that journey.
Wonderful. So maybe on Facebook we can post a few texts that people could look at, including the work of Fanon and Zygmunt Bauman and the like that you have mentioned.
And I'm sure his lectures are available on YouTube too. I mean, did you get a chance?
I haven't searched, but I wouldn't be surprised.
It's worth trying, to see him. Yeah.
So we'll continue this conversation on Facebook, and our Facebook page is BFM Night School. Yeah. You can also send questions to us at bfmnightschool@gmail.com. Yeah. And I'm on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Sharad Kutin. Sheryl, do you have a Twitter account, and do you want to interact with people over this issue?
I want to get more than 1,000 followers.
How many do you have now?
I have about 800.
That's impressive. Okay, so what is your Twitter handle then?
It's my name, Sharyl Hamdan.
Okay, so we thank you very much for coming on the show and sharing with us. We hope to have you back on again.
Thank you.
And remember, this show is repeated on Wednesdays at 9 p.m. We can live in the ether, We can live the heathen present in the ether. So join us on our Facebook page. Thank you so much, Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, Sheryl Hamdan, our guest today, and myself, Sharad Kutin, for Night School on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.